Hello and welcome everyone. My name is Mahmoud Ahmed and I'm really pleased to be here and glad you're watching this Counselling Tutor CPD video. This lecture is about reimagining mainstream practice, relationships and the curriculum. And within this lecture, you'll be able to begin practicing using a five-step wholeness model as a solution to embedding social context, identity, and EDI into your practice, supervision, and training. So, welcome. A bit about me. I've been in private practice for about 15 years. I live in Bracknell, Berkshire. I'm a therapist and author of A New Introduction to Counselling and Psychotherapy. It's about 5 years ago that I became more interested in standards within the profession at the baseline of practice and the curriculum, and then particularly about improving that baseline so that we are more stronger in that practice and helping in the relationship, as well as embedding EDI into it so it becomes part and parcel by design rather than an add-on. And that's the reason for this lecture, is to go through what the solution is for that as we go forward. So let's get started on that. So, just to introduce you to the learning outcomes for today, simply put, it will be begin understanding and applying the wholeness solution to your practice. Sometimes I'll call this the whole person practice. But what the whole solution means is how we embed these ideas of equity, context, and identity, and normativity and EDI into the mainstream ways of thinking about practice, client work, and so on. So, seeing this as part of the whole rather than separately, I'll talk a bit more about that. So, the learning outcomes: understand and able to explain why we need to do this, why the whole solution is important and critical for our continued sustainability in the profession. Understand and apply the five-step approach in daily practice. That's going to be the main part of today, to go through what that means. Develop an understanding of how the wholeness solution applies to across all pillars of practice. And when we talk about pillars of practice, we're talking about theory, we're talking about skills, we're talking about self-development, as well as practice in the world. And then also within the slide pack, you'll see, and at the end of the session, I'll talk a bit about the resources available for your continuing development as well. So, what are the requirements for the solution I'm going to present, and where do they align to? In terms of the scope and competencies, there's a clear focus in there on embedding context, diversity, inclusion throughout the practice and throughout the curriculum. So therefore that includes supervision, research, and so on as well. There is more and more of a theme of embedding EDI as well into the curriculum and training. And there's a tendency now to refer to that as EDI, whereas EDI previously was often remained an aspect of the organizational practices and, so for example, hiring practice and so on. So there are various competencies that are mentioned in the scope, and I'm not going to all of those, but we are in this solution, we are amalgamating and creating a composite image of that within the solution. So it includes context, intersectionality, power, culture, cultural context, language, rupture and repair. All those things are included in the solution and embedded in. Also, we have to then look at the ethics that are out there. So, with fair provision of services, human rights, safety for the client, inclusion of cultural contexts, and principles of justice, fairness are all in there, and they align very much to the requirements that we're providing a solution for. I'm not going to go through line by line the scope ed competencies that are relevant to infuse into practice here, but here is a list, so that you can maybe stop on this and have a look for yourself. Some of the areas that are important that can often be missed in practice. So today is going to be a whetting of the appetite. It's going to give you a high-level view of that strategic approach to embedding a whole image, a whole solution for practice where everyone is met and we have an equal proficiency for everyone, all things equal, so that we can actually meet accessibility needs, access needs, and so on. So if you want more details, is the book is out there. It's a whole baseline curriculum from fair self-development theory to practice to the relationship and skills, which embeds the context in there and those requirements that are defined within Scope Ed aligned to that. So first of all, I'd just like to go over some of the thinking about why we need to do this and what we need to resolve to come up with a solution for wholeness, as I call it, the embedding of context, identity, and EDI to make it whole as one cohesive solution rather than separate. So this is a sort of a call to the idea of the wholeness solution. So what this is showing us is that there are five easy steps. This is not difficult, is what I'm talking through here, and I'm going to prove to you why it's not difficult. There is a process to it, but the wholeness solution can be compared to being a drop in the ocean. The solution is designed to look at the ground of our practices and knowledge and theories, realign it and steer it a little bit, taking what we already have, not changing anything particular, but actually completing more of a picture of what we need at the baseline. So the idea is that once we adopt a wholeness solution, our profession will be stronger, more sustainable, our culture will be more inclusive for everyone. We'll have more growth in the profession and importantly, accessibility into the profession as well. The whole purpose of showing this diagram is to say this is not a big change, but it has the effect of having a huge change in terms of the culture of our profession and the relationship of repair and the health of the profession as well. So I do link this change to any aspects of issues we have within the professions, whether it's accessibility, whether it's fair wages, whether it's sustainability, whether it's about hierarchies and so on. I do relate this solution very much to a mandatory requirement to be able to do systemic change within our profession and also within society as well. So to understand the solution, I need to talk you through the landscape as we see it at the moment for our knowledge and the practices that we adopt within counselling and psychotherapy. So as you know, our roots of counselling and psychotherapy come from three schools primarily, humanistic, existential, cognitive behavioural, psychoanalytic and psychodynamic. Okay. So this has provided a firm base line for helping and the theories that we apply with client work and so on. However, the way we can profile that knowledge is that it's very much decontextualized and centralized knowledge. In other words, it doesn't account formally, and that's an important point, formally, explicitly, for the lived-in context of our lives, the societal, the cultural. It doesn't acknowledge things like identity and environment, the embodiment in that knowledge at the starting points. So this is the dominant baseline that we have around therapy, from which we have a common ground of knowledge. Okay. However, because there is an emphasis on thoughts, feelings, and behaviors, and it tends to focus less on the contextual, this replicates into other subjects. and the professional culture and structures of our client practice. Okay. So this idea of locating problems within clients, rather than the context of their lives, is a part of what we need to look at in terms of a solution. However, in response to those limitations, those constraints, even if though we can argue that they aren't explicit limitations, they're more implicit, or so there, these have been addressed through what I call secondary knowledge and practices. So when we think about secondary knowledge and practices, I'm talking about culturally informed practice, social and personal context informed, difference and diversity, identity, different communities, veterans, older people, race, gender, class, talking about mind, body, normativity and difference, neurodiversity, disability. We're talking about belief systems, worldviews, ultimate beliefs about existence, religion, spirituality, and so on, atheism, whatever we want to have, whatever beliefs we have. There is knowledge by experience that we don't tend to emphasize in the context. And obviously, then there is stress, trauma, and harm, which is embodied. So these are seen as separate to the core, as well as then things like communication styles, linguistics, EDI, and so on. So this is presenting the solution to the primary problem. So it's a response, the way I would like to frame this, to the issues in primary knowledge. This knowledge is then contextualized and decentered. In other words, there is lots of communities, lots of ways of looking at things. And this separation occurs between the primary and secondary knowledges and practices that then carry forward into the culture. When we talk about client work and so on, we may think about inadvertently about people A on the left-hand side and people B on the right-hand side. But actually, in actual fact, there is no real thing such as people A and people B because we all inhabit all of these similarities and differences as well. So the challenge then in terms of a solution is to make this whole. So rather than seeing primary and secondary knowledge as separate, to actually ask what we can do within the mainstream knowledge and practices to that these secondary knowledge and aspects are represented explicitly in the primary frameworks that we already adopt. So the idea of this diagram is to show we typically add on these things. So we may add on diversity, we may add on identity, we may add on knowledge about religion and spirituality. However, so far, this has been through adaptations and add-ons rather than the solution in the mainstream day-to-day practices. Okay. So the framing of the solution is around how we make wholeness out of this. The issue we have is actually there's quite a lot of complexity, a lot of moving parts. So how do we get our arms around this as a solution so that we can start that process of being stronger in the practice and more inclusive and equitable in the practice at the same time? So what I'm going to present now is the five-step wholeness solution. It's the framework, it's the five steps we all need to adopt to what I believe will be get us to a stronger whole and relational practice that is all things equal, proficient, and equal for everyone. Step one is to actually change the view of ourselves as a human self. As it is, when we are taught about human experiences, either in our minds or in books or theories, we are taught primarily about experience in this way, where a person has an experience. For example, the inner experience of body image issues, inner experience of not good enough or inferiority, whatever that is linked to the interpersonal world of relationships. And that's great, because that shows then, that there's an interplay between the interpersonal and inner relationships and how people experience that over time. This type of thinking is represented on books and theories, and it's the first thing that we usually learn about in training, is to think about each person as a human being, but decontextualized in that sense. So the issue with this model would be that there are gaps in fuller understanding of experience explicitly. I'm not saying implicitly this model doesn't work, because you could argue that actually it's open-ended in terms of where the experiences come from. But from a self-development, inclusion, and completeness perspective, it doesn't give you the full understanding of experience. Because where is the body in this, the mind body? Where is identity in this? Where are the belief systems in this that all frame our experiences in the world? By making those invisible, we then, the conversations are dominated on this model and they replicate into our culture, whereby our textbooks, our theories, our conversations about client were all centered on this model. And when we see that in training, it may give the impression of its exclusivity, because there's nothing on there that says we should be talking about different aspects of our context and our lives as well. So it constricts and it gives the impression that we can't represent different aspects of our context in there, whether it's our lived experiences, our voice from a different perspective, contextual empathy, precarious living, whatever it is, and the barriers and needs we have in our lives that can go unseen. So therefore, this is framing a key issue here in terms of the change and the solution we need to implement. So this fragments the understanding of self and contexts to later state adaptations. If this is our day one primary school model, it doesn't lend itself to that embeddedness of context, EDI, identity and diversity, into the model itself from day one. Okay, so what is the solution to that problem? Is that to simply formally add the contextual layers to the model itself. So in essence, we're not changing anything, but all we're doing here is formalizing the context around the experience. So hopefully this diagram is fairly intuitive, because it's simply saying our experience is within these six contexts around here. So when we think about our client work, think about supervision and so on, we are then have a frame of reference here, a contextual frame of reference, to think about the inner frame of reference and experience as well. So I'm not going to go through all the details of it, but simply put, our experience is formative of our high-level worldviews of how we see ourselves in the world, our social and personal identities and hierarchies, the culture of the context we live in, maybe the environment, maybe the history of that context, the knowledge that we learn, how do we form ideas of our beliefs and so on through knowledge that we learn through primary school, through learning skills, but also through knowledge by experience. Being a particular race, gender, class, of a mind and body difference, that is also knowledge as well. Embodiment, to reflect back, we aren't just thinking, feeling, and behavioral people. We have a body through which we experience the world. And the patterns are embedded in there, for example, relational patterns, survival instinct patterns of windows of tolerance, and so on. But also, our experience is formative of time as well. So, we are the lifespan. And the accumulation of our lifespan intergenerationally and collectively is passed through our DNA. So time is an important factor in the in understanding our experiences. I will give a few examples later on that, just to give you a feel for how we can start using that model in practice. So what this is suggesting is that this model then strengthens those gaps that I talked about. When we talked about primary and secondary approaches, this model has been thought about and encapsulates that what's missing at the mainstream baseline level of practice. So you'll see representation here of neurodiversity, for example, within the mind-body, disability, under identity, and so on. You'll see representation of the social context, the culture in the social context, if you like. So therefore, instead of saying now we need to embed every single knowledge and every single secondary practice back into mainstream practice, we're encapsulating it in the view of ourself in the first place, because a lot of those contexts that are secondary, nearly all of them, are applicable to all of us as universal human beings. So we need to have that starting point where we're seen with all those contexts already. So when it comes to understanding experiences, it's embedded already into that view of the point. So we will then, if we embed that within ourselves and our understanding, we carry forward that understanding into our day-to-day practice, supervision, and so on. It also provides a substantive view of our positionality as therapists in the relationship, who we are, who the client is, similarities and differences, and where we could be have blinkered areas of bias or just not knowing areas that are different or similar to us as well. In terms of the way this is now taught in training courses, would be that this is a day one activity. By visualizing this as a standard, what we're saying here is that then we reflect back on our own positions within this. So people are invited to talk about their identities, they're invited to talk about their worldviews, invited back to talk about their windows of tolerance, the body, the neuro difference, the knowledge, and how they see that. They're invited in to talk about all the contexts within day one experiences, understand that for themselves. So a day one activity would be to stop that and stop here and actually look at this diagram and ask questions of it. So if you're listening to this session, you can pause this or come back to it in your slides, perhaps work with your peers or in the training classroom and ask questions around how these contexts affect your experiences, good or bad, adverse or not. That's a good question to ask. And it's understanding each other in relationships and difference. Everyone feels from day one that they could talk about these areas as well. And it's important to note this isn't about difference. This is about normativity as well. In other words, this is for everyone to bring their own personal experiences, not directive. Is to bring their own experiences in there. Okay. So that's a real key for the solution as I go through the steps. Okay. There is a second level of detail available as well. Beyond that, there's a whole load of other aspects we can consider under each category. So again, to iterate, this is a mandatory part of inclusion. The second step then becomes slightly easier now because we've got a frame of reference that encapsulates the secondary approaches into a view of the self. So now we need to think about how we change the view of relationships. The current model of the relationship is very much like this. It's implicit, the contexts are not explicit in there. The relationship is there, we apply personal dynamics into the relationship. There's an emphasis on personal human-to-human dynamics rather than contextual dynamics. And there could be implementations of role power, depending on the theory that we're using as well. The issue with this model is that again, it doesn't explicitly consider the contextual aspects in the relationship. These are separate and secondary approaches. Therefore, the relational scope is more limited from that perspective. It excludes the relational contexts, such as belief systems, class identities, and so on. And number three, importantly, is that a person-to-person individualized empathy may actually be inadequate, shallow, and harmful without explicitly embedding context. So, for example, if we don't consider neurodifferences and disability in the client, and that's seen as secondary, we may be missing something that is very important for empathic understanding of the client. And therefore, language is another example of that, where actually we are trying to do a good thing by being relational, by excluding them, we are othering and inferiorizing the client unintentionally in that. So it's important to bring the context into the relationship itself. So the solution then will look at the relationship again slightly more, which may be surprising considering the relationship is something, we seem to have a lot of knowledge and understanding of. So where we need to revisit what the relationship means in terms of context here as well as individual experiences. The first point is that we tend to see the secondary approaches as separate to the therapeutic relationship. But however, secondary approaches are part and parcel of all therapeutic relationships at a certain level within the diagram of the context. So therefore, for example, if we are being trauma-informed and we're understanding about windows of tolerance or is autistic breakdown, masking and things like that, we are understanding about attuning to people's nervous systems. So therefore, that is a relational act by avoiding language that would be triggering, by attuning to differences of windows of tolerance and trauma. That is a relational act. It's not a secondary practice. Similar when we learn about race, gender, class, and we learn about social context, culture. These are not secondary practices because they exist for everyone, and they are all part and parcel of the relationship. They are separate to the relationship. The cultural way we talk about the relationship is very much based on a universal person-to-person understanding. And that's quite embedded into the culture. The second point is that we may consider the relationship in broad terms as the relationship. I'm having a good relationship with you, we're having a good relationship together. However, the secondary practices, especially, that bring into the idea that there's a multiplicity of relationships we have with each other, and they all some of those important to establishing the relationship overall. Again, not addressing marginalized positions, not addressing race, maybe something that's cut off from the relationship and inhibits these relationships being formed within the therapeutic relationship as well. Number three, knowledge that we gain is actually part and parcel of what leads to what I call pre-empathy. In other words, although clients are unique in their experiences, if we don't understand certain things, we are not ready to be empathically understanding of clients. That's the reason why we learn about different communities. That's the reason why we learn about neurodifference. That's the reason why we raise, learn about race and belief systems and religion and spirituality. So that this gives us a minimal baseline of understanding to be able to understand the client, even though we know we should take knowledge and theory lightly because ultimately it's about the client's own experience. Okay. And number four, we need to understand that the roots of empathy is understanding experiences in context. By understanding experiences in context, then we attune to the client's cultural context, their embodiment, their belief system, symptoms and so on. And from there, then we can attune our response. And those attunements could be about empathic responses, it could be about interventions, techniques, protocols, conceptualization, and so on, because it's quite logical then that if we understand and attune to the client's understanding or the client's world, the more quality of responses we'll give, the more quality of interventions we'll be able to provide. So therefore, the conclusion with the solution, if you like, is that the relational scope needs to be introduced as a construct within the relationship. In other words, those in context are part of the relationship. So therefore, this diagram is kind of showing you that we may think about relationship as something beyond, beyond chit chat, let's say, or small talk. It's below the surface, maybe feelings as well. But actually, we also need to think about not just the broad good enough relationship, but also parts and parcels of the multiplicity of relationships we will need to address, maybe, or broach, or repair, or however you want to call it, because of who we are. It's not always about what the client, that the client can't, is not ready to speak in this relationship. It's because the dynamics of power and difference in the relationship may cause the client not to trust the therapist. Classical examples would be marginalized identities, but it could be religion, it could be political views, and so on. And therefore, we need to be mindful of the multiplicity of relationships that may be hidden from view, but are very important in the therapeutic process. So therefore, the solution to hold solution fundamentally is the relationship. That's the core of it. By having a more formalized view of the context in all our lives, we then not only have dynamics of the relationship that are person-to-person level, human-to-human level, but also context-to-context. And these are all embedded in understanding of the relationships. In some ways, we can also think about the relationship as identity-to-identity, worldview-to-worldview, embodiment-to-embodiment, time generation to time generation, knowledge to knowledge, the truth. So therefore, it expands the relational scope. And this is key to keeping what we already have intact, because all we're saying is that we are expanding that relationship and understanding it. It implies then that relationship dynamics are, we need to factor the contextual as well as the personal into the relationship. And once we've done that, then we can consider things like power dynamics, affinity dynamics, similarity and differences between us, and the communication styles and processes that are different between us as well. So here, next step of that is actually we can think about other aspects of relationships as well. So how does the environment impact the relationship? How does the contracting impact the relationship? How does the outside world mirrored into the relationship as well? So again, I'm not going to go through detail on that now, but a simple example would be to say how societal positions of hierarchies, of class dynamics and so on, how they might appear actually within the relationship as well. And another aspect of it is that interconnected relationships, that our relationships are existing in the world as well, but relationships also exist between us and institutions, us and society, us within the planet ecosystem, and us within the mental health profession, for example. So therefore, the lens of relationships can be more broad and expanded as well. For example, a client, if they've had bad experiences of therapy, especially, they will see us as part of an institution, not just as a human being, but as part of an institution as well, potentially. So to sum it up then, for number two, is the fact that the relationship is the key to the wholeness solution, to embed context in there, EDI, identity, and all those myriad of contexts and depth of that. That's the way, that's almost the ripple effect. That's the little dot that gets us to a stronger, structurally inclusive, and fairer profession, and by visibility of that scope. Okay, it welcomes the whole experience, the whole of us into that experience, rather than limiting it to only the person and what we are thinking that we need to talk about experiences, but rather than the context as well. Number four, it's important to mention here that this approach then doesn't shift anything in the modality. In terms of the primary practices of humanistic, person-centered, cognitive behavioral, and psychoanalytical and dynamic, there could be an impact in terms of thinking about different theories and concepts in there, but that fundamentally doesn't shift anything, because things like self-concept, defenses, all we're saying is that these are in context. So it doesn't shift anything apart from just changing the way we, the formalizing the dynamics of the context in that. So conditions of worth, for example, how we feel about ourselves in the world, that comes not only from our personal experiences, but also society as well. If we are existing in a society where difference is marginalized and seen as other or less than, then that is a part of the self-concept. It's part of the introjects. It's part of the conditions of worth as well. So then, once we've done that, then it becomes easier. The rest of it really follows intuitively on that basis. So, in this slide, all I'm saying here is that the Wicket model, the worldview, identity, context, knowledge, embodiment, and time, we simply use that framework and keep it with us. So when we are talking about client work, skills, theories, we simply use it as a frame of reference to ask questions of that, of our experiences, of practice, of self-development, and so on. And I'll give a couple of examples of that as a continuous process. So here's an example of using the Wicket model. So in this case, I've used it particularly for social class. So you may want to stop this video at this point or come back to it in the slides. But all you need to do here is actually think about your social class position and ask questions. For example, ask questions about how does class influence the way you see the world of other people? Number two, how does class shape your identity and how you see yourself, and so on. So here is an application of the model, and there is no specific prescriptive way of using the model. It's important to know it's generative and based on what you want to bring in it. This is something I use for tutoring in counselling courses. Another example of how we can use the model is to think about a particular experience a client is having, or about a particular subject. Maybe we're doing training on grief, for example. So we can use the same Wicket model to ask questions and elaborate different ways that worldviews, identity, and context impact experiences of grief as well. So, for example, a client's worldview, how does that impact, influence the meaning of loss, life, and death? About justice, fairness, forgiveness, coping, and resilience. So, for example, someone may have a religious outlook on that. And so these are belief systems that can affect the experiences of grief and grieving. Similarly, we can think about time context at the end, impact on grief at life stages. How does grief impact someone as a child, as a teenager, as an adult? How does intergenerational grief play a part in that current grieving process is a key question as well. So I'm not going to go through all of that, but here's a chance to actually think for yourself in your own experiences of grief. Take each of these contexts and ask yourself, how did these influence your grieving process? Another example of the relationship model is to think about the embodied relationship. Okay, in this example, I talk about embodied prejudice. That actually is embodied feeling. It's not just about thinking biases and thoughts in our minds. It's about how we embody ideas and prejudices and interjects and discrimination potentially against other people. Example of this is a therapist, a middle class therapist, goes to a networking meeting and they ask someone, "Oh, what do you do?" "I'm a therapist." And the other person responds, "I'm a Uber driver." And the therapist then responds, "Oh, I see, that's interesting," but goes silent. In that moment, the therapist there is having a moment in the body experience where they don't know what to say. They don't know how to follow it up because their body freezes in a moment of time because they feel some sort of shame. How that shame plays out between the therapist and this particular person, this is not a therapy setting, by the way, but it could play out in the same way. That embodied freeze, that is the prejudice that's been held. Similarly, we can think about that in terms of other identities, homeless person or something like that. We can think about how the embodied relationship works rather than just the thinking and the feeling relationship. What's the body telling us about our prejudice? Why is this happening? So number five then is that we then need to think about our place within practice, our place in terms of providing a service to clients, not only just as individuals, but part of an organization. We may own an organization, or be part of a training provider, and so on. How are we serving the whole population? We can ask a question that simply asks who might be advantaged or disadvantaged by gaps in proficiency that I've highlighted? Who might be more at risk of harm? Why? What is the enabling structure and societal barriers within our organization, our practice, or within society? For example, waiting lists and funding, for example, and fair pay, anything that comes to mind. Which groups will we be able to serve better than others? And this gives rise to consciousness in terms of who is there in the therapy room, who is not there. Yeah. And why is that there? Examples could be about language barriers, it could be about neuro differences, disability, accessibility, and so on. So therefore, we need to think about become conscious of who is advantaged or disadvantaged more or less in different ways we could be by the current setup when we decontextualize practice. So how do we address those? So what we can do, and I'm not going to go into detail again, you can sort of pause on the slide, is to have a map of some sort in your brain or your mind about how our practice and proficiency affects the service we provide. So think about the proficiency and curriculum and the training that we received. Think about how we deliver that service. What is the culture of the organization that delivers a service? Is it a safe environment? Is it got good cultural messages? Is it welcoming for all? Is it inclusive? Is it representative? Do we develop relationships that are based on a wholeness solution, or do we decontextualize and so on? Then we can also think about how all the ecology of our mental health systems impact practice as well. So it could be to do with contracting, it could be due to limited time sessions, it could be to do with research, it could be to do with AI. Whatever it is, how does that influence our service provision as well? But then at the structural and social, cultural, societal level, we can think about legal aspects. We can think about stigma, taboo, also within as a whole, but also within different communities as well. And then when we come to think about our own service, we think about not only the what we do, as a sort of what we can do, but also the barriers that may be faced from clients that come to our practice, organization, and so on. And I'm not saying, suggesting that every individual must solve this problem of access for everyone at a right proficiency and accessibility, but it's about gaining some conscious of that. A service definition view is helpful, I think, because it actually helps us to identify what we do and what we don't do, who or what access requirements are meeting. For example, are we providing accessible building facilities, addressing sensory needs in the environment, and so on? How usable it is, and what adjustments we can make, different languages, care, for example, having personal assistance for disabled people, for example, could be example of that. Clear communication and language. This enables us to become conscious of and be more definite about what service we're providing and who we're not providing for. So that's the whole steps to wholeness. So it's five steps through whole self, change the view from today, if you're in this, to a whole self view with context. Use that in your self practice, supervision, etc. Think about the relationship as a whole, with embedding personal and contextual elements into the relationship. Formalize that. Number three, continually think about WICKET. Embed that into daily practices, into our trainings, and so on. Number four, build the structural context. Number five, which we haven't covered, but is now going to be about advocacy. If we want the change we want to have as a universal design at the baseline, we've got to advocate for it. It can't just be a few people. It has to be for everyone to do it. So advocacy can mean sharing this model, talking about this model, sharing it with your training providers, and so on. There'll be other resources that are developed here as well. For example, guidelines around how to provide training that is based on this, that is more inclusive as well. So I just want to end by thinking a bit about the wholeness solution as it applies to across all the pillars of practice. How do we embed this within the foundational pillars, causation, theory, relationship, skills, and practice? And this is covered in the book. But in essence, what we're saying here then is to provide that ripple effect where we have complete understanding of context within all the fields of our discipline of our practice. We need to then think about the whole of this ethics, supervision, competencies, research, as well as all these pillars of practice, to have a more whole solution, an embedded solution for practice. An example of that, I just want to give you one example of that from the book, is that in the relationship, for example, the context is embedded into the five modes of the relationship that was originally produced by Petruska Clarkson's model. If you don't know the model, but in essence, this model was actually saying that there are five parallel relationships in the way we can understand relational relationships. It's a whole inclusive model. So, for example, working alliance, transference, or barriers, if you want to call that, and so on. So, in the book, this is embedded. In addition, by thinking about the model within what we do already, we can ask questions by understanding what could be missed out of that without considering context. So, for example, in this model, I've introduced a communication and meaning relationship as the way of, as another part of the relationship, which is about how do we understand each other inclusively, how do we understand the correct meaning of it, given the differences that we can have, cultures, neuro differences, and so on, that this is an important part of the linguistic model, an inclusive model. For example, inclusive language, for example, is part of that model, and how we mask and shift communication. That's an example, for example, from neurodivergence as well. So this is just to give you a feel for the way this model is used within the book to provide a more whole solution to the baseline of the curriculum. Similarly, for relational skills that we have, looking at some of the additional things that we need. An example would be broaching the relationship. If this is contextual, and if this is saying that these could be limiting factors or become barriers in the relationships, sometimes as a therapist, we may need to broach empathically, contextually, aspects that could be blocked in the relationship based on these contexts as well. So there are some more skills that are defined within it. And there's also a set of contextual skills that help us through navigate the conversations around context and how it might affect the client and how we can help clients explore that in a client-centered way. For example, how does the, I've been talking about neurodivergence care quite a lot, but how does the adaptation, how do we broach how a client needs to adapt to the environment and acculturate and change themselves? How does that affect them? That is part of parcel of a skill base that we need to all have. Okay, the other one example is advocacy, discrimination, oppression, these things as well. So I'm coming to the end now. So that is the fundamentals. I hope you found that useful. I know there's a lot there, but if we in essence we call it the relationship embedded with context, that is the answer, and that's hopefully a simple answer to how we move away from this decontextual person-to-person only approach, but we can actually embed it all of anything in that. So the book is there, waiting for you to read. It's available in train. It's good for trainers as well as students and therapists because it maps Scope Ed, it maps the curriculum, and it has lesson plans and self-development exercise to go through all of this in ourselves, as well as providing knowledge and understanding and examples, case studies of different identities and contexts as well. So, advocacy point would be to say, if you found this useful, please shout it out. Please let us know. If you're using the model already or you plan to use it, please let us know because it helps us understand and that it's having an effect out there. Please to also say that the model is being used by training providers who are providing a course based on the model. So it's going to be embedding it from day one as well. There are various resources available and reference points for today's training, including a free video audio lessons on the course, as well as images that you've seen here, all usable by you as well. Okay, thanks very much.